Welcome back to the DocSF podcast. I'm Dr. Stefano Bini, your host. Today's episode features our MedTech Frontiers session, a fast-paced look at the technologies shaping healthcare's future. You'll hear from Dr. Daniel Kraft on innovations outside orthopedics, Dr. Fabrizio Billy on what contextual AI truly means, Brandon Barbello with an update on physical AI, and Dr. Douglas Yunus on autonomous robotic surgery. Let's head to the DocSF stage with our dynamic moderator, Unity Stokes from Startup Health, as he introduces our speakers.
I just want to say, what an exciting time to be alive. Today, we're going to be talking about how we are approaching the realm of science fiction. And for the past 15 years, I've been working on more than 10 global health moonshots. These are things like, how do we eradicate Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, cancer, longevity. And one of the reasons I'm so excited to be in this room is all of these moonshots depend on mobility. And I believe we need a mobility moonshot because, as we all know, motion is life. So today we're going to be giving four amazing presentations, starting with Dr. Daniel Kraft here. And this is going to be a challenge because you normally have about 500 slides and we have less than 10 minutes to get through your presentation. And we're going to go down the line here, but we are at a moment, just to kick things off, where what I believe is a great mutation. And this is really a merge of a lot of exponential innovations happening at one time that are now converging into a net new realm of possibility that is impacting our health and well-being. Not only are we talking about AI, but there's materials. There's a whole wave of innovation around batteries, bio, neurotech, robotics, but also design, business models. All of these are converging. So to kick things off and talk about some of these convergence, Daniel, would you bring us home? Because you're going to be talking about how we're pushing the boundaries outside of ortho, and then bring us back to how this impacts all of us in this room. So over to you.
Thanks so much. Great to be back here for the 10th year. Congratulations, Stefano. Amazing to see what's happened in the last 10 years. The future is coming faster than you think. It's an interesting time across health and medicine and society writ large. I love this quote, the pessimist complains about the wind, the optimist expects it to change, the leader just to sail. And I think across health and medicine, we have a lot of new winds at our back that can hopefully move us forward across the whole continuum of health and medicine. And now, of course, it's easy. And I made those images with AI. Of course, now you can make videos with AI. I made this just last night in 10 seconds. So that's getting kind of easy to do. Of course, you can make Stefano as a superhero, the Lego version. You can now animate him with Grok in all sorts of disturbing ways. But, you know, that's becoming table stakes. But it's showing how amazing technology is now fast. It's advancing, right? It's already better than most of us passing the medical boards. It's defeating us in diagnostics. This idea that the future is coming faster than you think is emerging, and it applies to almost every medical field. Though there's some downsides, right? You know, some quotes, I trust AI more than doctors. I don't think I'm the only one, all the way to, you know, what's the future of medical education and the role of the physician and clinician writ large. There's also sort of this quote I love to share from Sam Altman, that GPT is like an e-bike for your mind, which is great, but what if your kids never learn how to ride a regular bike or never develop the braking muscles, or your residents and medical students never develop a differential diagnosis by themselves? So there's some downsides and upsides to this fast-moving age. And some recent studies showing that we can get de-skilled, right? Whether it's in writing essays or for our friends in GI who can no longer recognize polyps without the help of AI. So pluses and minuses going forward. But I think we're all optimists. We already heard a bit of the theme about agentic health. I think we're going to end up in this era of generative health, where we each have our sort of own super personalized agents. We're seeing early versions of those. Even Stefano back in 2021 had shown this amazing soul version of having an agent with a post-op patient. But now it's becoming reality, right? Maybe it's for the basics of having patients reminded to have their visits or do their pre-op or post-op care. But we're rapidly entering this age of agentic health, where each can have our sort of personal super agent that matches our age, culture, personality, health goals going forward. I don't think we want to use these agents to replace our nurses. Of course, that's kind of an impossibility, but we need to think of how we blend those into our continuum of care, sometimes blending with physical AI and robotics, particularly for our older populations who can leverage these to hyper-personalize their home care as we move from hospital to home. And as we sort of merge in this personal health agent age, they're going to continuously sift through our wearable data. Google and DeepMind have been publishing new elements where you can get really deep insights from just simple Whoop or Fitbit or Oura Ring, and that's going to play a huge role in the orthopedic space. So the challenge with all these emerging technologies is how do we go from where we are now, sort of intermittent reactive secure era, to a future that's true healthcare, that's continuous, proactive, personalized, anytime, anywhere. A lot of these things are here, but the incentives are misaligned. We don't practice evidence-based medicine. We practice reimbursement-based medicine. So part of that shift from now to next is mindset. And thinking about how the super convergence that Unity talked about takes us forward, right? We have a whole new set of tools that didn't exist when I was a Stanford medical student in the 1990s that kind of makes us, can take us into this future age. So our challenge here at DocSF is not to have a failure of imagination of what's going to be possible the next decade when we come back for DocSF 2035, right? I've been sort of at this convergence for a while. I chair a conference called Next Med Health, where we bring folks from the Dean Kamens and Eric Topols to famous surgeons to think about this future. And it often isn't about, again, the technology, but about mindset. We have the head of NHS there every year, who I love when he shares this quote, that the difficulty lies not in the new ideas, but escaping from the old ones. So you guys are leaders in orthopedics. It's about mindset shift, not just technology. So a few examples of things that are moving quickly, of course, genomics. You know, a decade ago it was about a $10,000 genome. Now we're down to about an $80 genome, on the way to a $10 genome. How might that be used in everything from pharmacogenomics to pick the right opiate to cholesterol meds? Here's an AI-generated cartoon. According to your genome, you're genetically predisposed to obsess over your genome. That's starting to happen. That was an AI-generated prompt. And we're starting to see the connection of the dots, like UK Biobank and Genomics England is now integrating genomic information into the workflows of nutritionists, primary care docs, surgeons, and beyond. We're not able to just read DNA. We're in the era of writing DNA. You've seen the sort of evolution of CRISPR-based therapies. One of my fellow Aspen friends just climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, which wasn't a big deal for him. He's an ICU doc in his 40s, but he brought with him Jimmy, who about 5 years ago had sickle cell disease, which was cured by CRISPR therapy. Now can now climb Mount Kilimanjaro. So pretty amazing. I got to tell the story to Jennifer Dow, the Nobel laureate. Speaking of Nobel laureates, we're seeing the evolution of now the ability to design proteins with DeepMind and unfolding elements. So that's affecting the whole pharmacologic space and pharma space. How we're going to go from target to drug and run those in silico moving forward. So a pretty exciting time with AI and drug discovery. And then moving that upstream to treating disease at stage zero. We're seeing the first therapies, which will do gene therapy to knock out the genes for hypercholesterolemia, for example, before the patient ever has the need for therapy. So exciting time to look at all these omics, not just genome, but now the low-cost proteome, exposome, metabolome, microbiome. Low-cost GGMs are on the market. It's not about any one of these technologies, but how we put them together, including the immunome. And I want you to kind of have that takeaway of thinking about not the future of any one ohm, but this idea of multimodal health. How do we take these new omics that are getting faster, better, cheaper, and mash them together? Because any one data set is interesting, but when you put them together, you can sort of enter this age of sort of wisdom-based crowdsourced knowledge, or often sort of synthesized in this idea of the digital twin, whether it's for your knee or for your heart or for your whole population. So watch that space. So the thematic I think we've seen over the last 10 years is the world is getting more digital. Many of the analog technologies we trained with are now digitized and dissolved, particularly related to the surgical sphere. What used to be a kludgy device is shrinking into our metaglasses. That's going to be more and more useful across outpatient, inpatient. You've already seen examples of your colleagues building this into the operating room space for spinal fusions, for example, the ability for you to cognify and see complex anatomy. Our friend Dr. Grossman has been pioneering these technologies to help with rounding and taking you through your workspace and guiding you with like a GPS in the clinical space. And of course, in the operating room, you know, we're having the black box of from the pilot's cockpit to the operating room, which is to start measuring almost every element of a procedure and giving you guidance. And of course, now assisted more and more by robotics. So where might that be in a decade as these get more integrated? I think it's going to sort of be the equivalent of from regular driving to partial driving to all the stages we're having now that we see embodied in our Waymos. If you haven't had one, a ride while you're in San Francisco, take your self-driving car experience is quite transformative. And that some of that self-health and self-driving elements can come to healthcare. I was just in Israel for the first time in a while at Sheba Medical Center. They're starting to take this mindset of, you know, the digital air traffic control and integrate that into their hospital systems, kind of air traffic control for your inpatient, outpatient discharge and beyond. Of course, diagnostics is moving exponentially. The, you know, the analog scale is now doing a shape scale, which might be relevant in orthopedics to get weight and muscle mass and fat mass and changes in skin. We're seeing new abilities to use cameras to pull up all sorts of vital signs. So it's no longer just a wearable. Voice is a biomarker now, which can pick up everything from blood pressure to blood glucose. So that might be a new form of all the diagnostics coming to your mobile device. That's getting exciting. So this idea of wearables is expanding. The phone is becoming a platform, of course, for this. And as the wearables emerge, we're now seeing the first FDA versions that can do real-time blood pressure, real-time blood sugar. Of course, Apple just announced that you can start to measure blood pressure and soon blood sugar. So how's that going to affect your practice as we have this sort of continuous data coming to us at all times? And then there's new forms of diagnostics, ingestibles. A short example of a small integrated device called the PillBot. I actually got to swallow one. And this is what it looks like. It's an upper GI and a small pill. So that's a big pill to swallow, but it does an upper GI, basically. It's drivable with a game controller. I'm talking to the head of GI at Mayo Clinic remotely, and now I'm steering it. So that's the idea, you know, a fantastic voyage. And there's patchables and earables, and of course, AirPods Pro 3 will measure your vital signs and sweatables, and this integration of no one wants to have a wearable for every technology. They're starting to integrate. Our friends at BioIntelliSense now have a patch you may have seen that's basically an ICU in your pocket, and the ability to now sort of have that foresight insight, particularly for post-op care, is really going to change our sort of hospital-to-home experience. The ability to synthesize an ICU data on an integrated patch, I think, is quite powerful. Of course, many of you, I saw a poster out about using Oura Rings to start leveraging real-time information, not just for sleep and exercise, but to give you really proactive information.
I want to get one question.
Sure. So
we're experiencing this great mutation. Mm-hmm. We've seen all these tools. Bring us back to this room. How do we actualize all these tools in the realm of orthopedics and for the folks here? What should we be thinking about?
I think, you know, the future is already here, just not evenly distributed, is another famous quote. I think the opportunity is to not wait for that future. I'd ask you where it hurts, but your wearables have already booked your MRI at 315. So to that point, right, you don't need to wait to put these things together. There's a lot of technologies out there. As Unity knows, we have a platform called digital.health, where it's a bit of a formulary of now over 5,000 digital health solutions, so you can look for orthopedic solutions and beyond. So what to do now is, like, don't wait to find those gaps, find the solution that might already exist, start to play with it in your clinic, in your outpatient realm, and that will sort of connect the digital orthopedic space and catalyze that future faster.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We have heard about artificial intelligence, but today we're now going to talk about contextual intelligence. Dr. Fabrizio Billi, bring us to this new world of some new terminology and some new things we're going to learn about.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. I'm very honored to be here, as usual. So we are transitioning out of pure pattern recognition. Multimodal models already exist, and RAG systems are being deployed for clinical documentation. Spatial computing is here and is already deployed in some operating rooms. These are real advantages, but here's what is missing: orchestration. We actually previously heard, talk about orchestration. These components work in isolation. A radiologist might use AI to search, to read the images, then manually search the literature, and then document in a separate system. There's no integration, no dynamic coordination based on context. The leap we need to make is store contextual intelligence. Here's the core insight. Data tell us what's happening. Context reveals why it matters. Think about the difference. A glucose reading of 180 tells us what. But knowing it's 3 a.m., the patient just worked a night shift, skipped dinner, and took insulin at the wrong time, that's context. And it completely changes what we do next. In orthopedics, we generate a massive amount of data, biomechanics, patient-reported outcomes, imaging, wearables, you name it. Data without context, though, is noise. We just don't need to know what the knee extension is. We need to know what they are for in the patient life. So contextual intelligence requires mainly three block buildings, and they are key to understanding how different is this approach. Spatial computing gives us computational awareness of geometry, motion, and environment in 3D. It's been used in OR, as we said, less used in understanding how the patient goes on with their lives. Unlike static imaging, this dynamic spatial awareness anchors computation where things are happening, not just where they are. Semantic clustering groups things by meaning, not just keywords. And agentic RAD, which is a fairly new concept, is an orchestration layer where large language models coordinate retrieval, reasoning, and tool use. And those three building blocks are integrated into four functional layers. In the first layer, we unify representation and meaning. So we take multimodal images, sensor data, text, voice, and we create a semantic space through embedding and clustering. In layer two, we use spatial computing, 3D location, movement, and environment mapping. In layer three, we use contextual retrieval reasoning. So we use agentic RAG to orchestrate retrieval analysis of data and literatures. And finally, layer four is the action and feedback, where the adaptive decision and support adjust workflows based on real-time sense context. And here is a one case study. So how that can translate in practice. Here's David. He's 17, he's a high school winger and post ACL reconstruction. He goes to the rehab, and at the representation layer, we are unifying all the data that we can get from sensors, a reaction force vector, IMU, EMG, takes pain, fatigue scores. The context capture layer collects the clinical and the field information. It finds that the COP trajectory is more unstable on the pitch than in the lab. And it also finds that the patient has a quad weakness. The PT is not convinced that this is just due to anxiety. So the pitch behavior is different from the lab, not because David is afraid to return to play. In the contextual retrieving reasoning layer, we expand the scope. So we collect data on sleep, stress, workout, even analysis of past video games. So what the system now detects is gait alteration months pre-injuries. And now a biomechanical analysis of what happened finds out that 6 months before injuries, David changes shoes, his cleats, for a much cooler pair. And the biomechanical analysis showed that the distribution of the new cleats created a new load distribution, a valgus moment, which slower his reaction. 6 months later, his brain wasn't tracking where his body was going. And so now, obviously, the final in the action, the PT and the AI, but the PT obviously makes the recommendation, changed completely the rehab to proprioceptive retraining, neuromuscular education, etc. The final here is that David goes back to be a star player and gets a scholarship. This is another case study. This is in DOR. So in DOR, this becomes even more powerful. The representation layer fuses CT, MRI, intraoperative imaging. We already saw some glimpse of it. Spatial computing maps the surgical field, tracks movement, even minor movement of the patient on the table. And so highlights on the VR, on the extended reality, the best route to plug in the screw. The surgeon doesn't have to listen to the AI, and possibly he will not. But the fact that he's refocusing his attention to something that might go wrong makes the surgery in the end much more successful. So where does this leave us? The technical component of contextual intelligence already exists. We saw it previously. What doesn't exist is the integration framework that orchestrated it. The path forward requires four things: clinical pilots that demonstrate values, data standard that enable integration, open source frameworks that prevent monopolization, and validation protocol design for adaptive system. But without contents, the scalpel that guides precision becomes blunt. And both patient and clinician, instead of gaining, lose agency. Thank you.
This is very exciting. Walk us into the very near future, let's say 3 years. I know you mentioned 3 years ago. Now let's go 3 years into the future. How will we start to see contextual intelligence impacting all of us? That could be anything from in the surgery room to our soccer cleats, it sounds like. Bring us into this near future.
So obviously, as you can imagine, this is an agentic world. It's not done with just one tool or one operating system or one algorithm. So It's funny because just last year, we started discussing here at DocSF about multi-agent system, and that was fairly new, just 1 year ago. Now, we don't talk other than multi-agent systems. So this is where the future is in a multi-agent system that will help us and will be Copilot. But here's the big difference. AI is not going to be here to tell us what to do, but to suggest what would be the best road to achieve a certain goal. And ultimately, it's going to be our intelligence and our judgment to follow that suggestions.
So more of this merge of man and machine.
Absolutely. Like.
Okay. Next up, we're going to be talking about physical AI with Brandon Barbello from Archetype AI. Brandon.
Cool. Thanks, everyone. First off, it's really cool to be here. My co-founders and I and our whole team has no background in healthcare, no background in medicine, but we're working on something fundamental for AI for the physical world. And in the spirit of DocSF, it's really great to be here and be able to share what we're working on and where possible cross-pollinate, you know, how techniques applied here can be applied there and discover whole new possibilities. So we have a bit of a different take on what's now become a buzzword as physical AI. We were the first to grab the Twitter handle for it, and so we have the bragging rights there. But more recently, folks like NVIDIA, for example, have popularized it as AI models for robots or for self-driving. But the team that we have is a background that's a bit more foundational in sensors. And sensors aren't just in robots, they aren't just in cars. They're in all of these things that we've already been deploying over the past 20 to 30 years. And so there's a huge amount of data that is now being created and a need for new approaches to more rapidly and more generally unlock the value of that physical world data. And so that's the spirit of what we've been working on. We actually come at this from the consumer devices world. My co-founders and I before this were at Google, and we led work for Google's consumer devices like Pixel phones and Android phones and Nest devices on understanding things about people and spaces through those devices' sensors. And what we experienced, which is common to anyone working with sensor data, is that it's now easy to collect a lot of data, but to actually do something with it with AI, you have to build a big data set. Some human expert has to label it. You have to train a model. And once you've done so, that model can do just one thing, and it's usually some kind of a basic detection task. More recently, though, there's been the emergence of these foundation models, and these are most popularly experienced as large language models, and they're based on these transformer approaches. But what's very exciting is that those approaches aren't just for language. They can work with any kind of data. What we've been building at Archetype is a foundation model called Newton that can understand not only language, but also the world of sensor data. And so it can perceive the world in ways that we can and in ways that we can't. And in doing so, discover things about the world or discover things inside data to help us build these AI sensing systems faster. And so the outcome of what we've built is a bit like a ChatGPT for the physical world, insofar as the model also lets you ask or ask about or act on the sensor data and not just text. We have built this model into a bigger platform that's focused on building agents for the physical world. We've got customers across the manufacturing space and the energy space and consumer devices and car companies all using this platform to build agents for their tasks from their sensor data with the Newton model, very much putting into effect what Fabrizio was just describing, this fusion of sensor data. I won't go too deep into those. However, we've gotten some results recently focusing on human motion data that we're excited to share. So to zoom into the model, into Newton itself, internally, Newton actually has two components. One is focused on understanding the physical world, and one is focused on translating the physical world into things that humans can understand. And this is really key because the kind of data that we are talking about, it isn't just text, it isn't just pictures, it isn't just video. It's these time series physics-based signals. And they're not only difficult to interpret, they're difficult to label, they're difficult to train on. And so the sum of this slide here is showing that this is a model that is massively multimodal, lets you put any mix of signals into the model, and the model can generate any kind of signals out. So how we train this model to learn the physical world, to learn physics, is a bit different from other approaches that, you know, folks have mentioned today. We don't give the model physics equations. we don't train the model explicitly on human knowledge about physics. Instead, we just give the model lots of examples through sensors of things in the physical world happening. And this is really key because thus the model can learn things directly from experience and can learn things that people can't label or find patterns that people aren't able to see. And so we built this model and we've now tested it on a wide range of things, from mechanical systems to electromagnetic systems to power consumption, all manner of physical processes. And this model that was never trained on those sensors, never trained on these systems, has been able to generalize. Just like large language models have been trained on a huge mass of language and now can generalize to language-based tasks, we seem to be achieving the same thing, but for physics-based tasks with sensor data. And so this is a huge unlock because you can now use your data with this model and no longer have to make a sensor-specific or task-specific model first. You can shortcut the 12 months or $1 million it takes to build that classical model and just get to value. And so we published these results in a paper late last year, and in the time since working with our customers, we found this works for all manner of physical equipment, from manufacturing tools to wind turbines to horizontal drills. But recently, exploring Stefano's thesis around mobility as a vital sign, we've been doing these explorations of human motion. And as some basic results here, you can see how we can feed this data in, and it generates these natural clusters. When you then apply the labels to those clusters, you can see these fascinating out-of-the-box patterns begin to form. You can see, for example, in this chart on the right, these nuances where running is differently clustered from Nordic walking, or walking from ironing, or going up the stairs versus down the stairs. There are these very subtle nuances that the model on its own is able to break apart through these hidden patterns, this kind of semantic context that Fabrizio was just referring to. So we've now gone further and applied this to some open source data, likewise looking for these hidden clusters, and are finding likewise an out-of-the-box ability to cluster younger versus older versus patients who have osteoarthritis, or likewise control patients versus those with Parkinson's. And so we're able to find these deeper hidden signals that can drive new ways to discover patterns in data, and this new ways to do diagnoses or to explain context and discover things in this massive medical data that we now have. While these results are still early, I want to show some more mature results that show where this is all going. So back on our other physical world work, we've gotten results like this, where we take those physics results or world perception results, we combine them back with language, and we can do very impressive things. And so here, for example, is a benchmark on visual spatial intelligence, where the task is just to navigate some physical space. Maybe it's a hospital in the future, maybe it's an operating room, but navigate a space and do some task. And because Newton can reason across time and space and context, you see here in blue, much better results, even at only 7 billion parameters compared to Gemini or Qwen or GPT-5 that isn't built at all to think about physical world tasks. Likewise for planning routes, the same thing, this kind of training on physical world data, learning directly from experience, results in very different capabilities from these models purely trained on human knowledge and purely trained on human language.
Brandon, thank you so much. This is just amazing. You had a throwaway line there, mobility as a vital sign, and I hope we get to talk a little bit more about that later today or throughout the day. I think it's one of the most significant things that could really be impacting human health is having that kind of frame of a new vital sign that's easy, that could then be integrated throughout all these other tools through our world. Brandon, one quick question. One trend I'm seeing is that a lot of the consumer grade devices are actually becoming more sophisticated than the medical grade devices. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. What are you seeing? I mean, you're in this world of physical AI and sensors, and they're very advanced and sophisticated now, and they're being used throughout our world in many ways. What are your thoughts there?
That's certainly true. And what's exciting about it on top of that too is that they're combining many different ways of measuring in the same device. And so you can do these multimodal tasks, and you can thus find these correspondences between signals, and you can translate between signals such that you can either do deeper things than any one signal is able to do, or if you have some other device, maybe some device back in a medical environment that's less sophisticated, you could learn from the sensor fusion on that consumer device to do a similar task on a less advanced device with fewer sensors. And so this kind of sensor cross-learning, because you can now find these patterns outside of language, is one of the big unlocks of these techniques. And I do want to acknowledge what Fabrizio was presenting insofar as what we're ultimately building toward is the ability to put all these signals together, human readable and not, to build this full contextual picture and get these deeper insights.
Amazing. Thank you. Now we're talking about surgical robotics. I think this is an area that is going to be of great interest to all of us. Bring us home here.
Okay, so we're switching to a pretty ortho-heavy subject. I'm just curious, how many orthopedic surgeons are in the audience? Okay, all right, we can speak the same language. So here we sit in the land of self-driving taxis and Friday night robotic boxing matches in San Francisco. So in 8 minutes or less, I'm going to explore the question about whether or not it's possible to use technology to fully automate a procedure that's done almost a million times a year in the United States and make it, for want of a better term, idiot-proof. But first, we need to ask a question. Why, with all this technology that's out there, does the vast majority of knee replacement surgery look like this? When, if you go down the street to the Tesla factory, it looks like a ballet of dancing metal giants, and this is how we're doing it in the operating room almost 80% of the time still. So like a lot of us in this room, I'm a tech optimist at the very least. And while orthopedic robotics is still in its infancy, I think it's going to continue to evolve. And I think that autonomous robotic systems can ultimately become a lot slicker, for want of a better term, and less frustrating to the surgeons, and that we can improve some of the pain points like point registration and putting pins in the bone that surgeons complain about as these systems evolve. But it's also, these systems that we're working on are not just going to make us more accurate. They're going to change the way we do the surgery. They're going to change the targets that we're trying to hit and tell us what the right target is for whatever patient. They're going to make us faster, less prone to error, and maybe even drive implant design. Because if you're making implants for use with manual instruments, maybe if you have a robot that can do certain things, you completely reimagine the implant itself. My ex-wife likes to tell me that all I'm doing by working on this is putting myself out of a job, and maybe she's right. So what can be automated? If you break down total knee replacement surgeries into a few components, there are a bunch of different things that we can automate, and there are a lot of speakers that you're going to hear today, and I already have heard, that are working on some really cool elements that are going to be critical in automating an entire knee replacement. This is the aforementioned Friday night robotic boxing matches here in San Francisco. So we could talk about a lot of different things that we can automate with a knee replacement, but I think everybody wants to see a robot cutting by itself. So that's pretty much what I'm going to concentrate on. So this is the Monogram robot. It's cutting autonomously, we say. It really drives more like a train. It's pedal controlled, and it's driving, the saw is going on a track. If you think about it like driving a subway car, I'm from New York, you know, the foot pedal can go backwards and forwards, faster and slower, start and stop, but it's on a track. And the blade of the saw goes through a gate, which is a kind of a safe spot. We think of it as a virtual jig in the bone, and it will never go outside of that. So the reason that we went down the road of autonomous is I told my team, guys, we, in the operating room with robotic systems, stuff is in the way, right? So if you're a person that's been doing manual knee replacements for years and you start doing robotic knees, you're just in the way of everything. Like your assistants are in the way, you're in the way, you can't get in the way of the cameras. And it's, if you have a system that still needs all of the assistance that you used to, but now your assistants are in the way, those systems don't have a lot of adoption. So I said, guys, we need to keep the blade in the bone. We need to make a system so that the surgeon doesn't need all these assistants, can basically do it by himself. And that way, we don't have to worry about things being in the way. And you can see right on that shot there, it's just me doing a knee with a single retractor that I don't really even have to hold. And by designing a system like this, you really allow the surgeon a lot of freedom to kind of pay attention to the surgery. One way you could do this, accomplish the same thing, would be to have haptic boundaries and have the surgeon actually driving the saw. unfortunately, somebody already thought about that and I had to come up with something else. But it turns out that autonomous is actually really advantageous compared to a haptic system. We're able to kind of make it more efficient to orchestrate every move that the robot makes and really increase safety, efficiency, speed, et cetera. But it's not without challenges. So designing a system where you have a saw autonomously cutting, it's not easy. And we started with a rotary tool. And what we found was the rotary tool was pretty easy to make do what we wanted it to do, but it was really slow. And we just couldn't, you know, the saying speed kills is true in orthopedic robotics, except it's slow speed kills. Like if you have a system that's going to double your OR time, you can forget it. So we tried everything we could to make a rotary tool work. We just couldn't make it go fast enough. So we switched to a saw. The problem with a saw is that there's the human hand and eye is really, really good at doing certain things, avoiding soft tissue, dampening vibration, cutting efficiently. Like I can give an intern a saw and they're pretty intuitive about making micro adjustments to make the saw cut efficiently. So what we had to do is make a robot do all those things that a human does. And I had to translate that to the engineers and say, well, I need the saw to kind of peck, to peck at the bone. And so we had to innovate on the system to resist its weaknesses, like vibration. We had to put dampeners in the blade. We had to orient the end effector so they wouldn't upset the robot with vibration. We had to change the weight distribution of the saw and optimize the oscillation rate so that it wouldn't vibrate the whole system too much. We had to figure out what was the optimal oscillation speed. And we were able to innovate ways to really make the saw efficient. We upped the horsepower of the motor, and we have current demand that detects when the robot is hitting really hard bone. It'll speed up through soft bone and slow down in hard bone. And so this is how we've kind of been able to get a saw to do automated cutting safely and effectively. I want to recommend custom implants is another thing you can do with a robot. This is a custom milling tool that we have that can make a cavity in a bone that can incorporate a custom implant that's very low profile, low form factor, very, very stable, 300% more stable than an off-the-shelf press-fit implant. But two books that I think just put on your list to read, one of them is written by this Cambridge professor. It's called A World Without Work, and it sounds pretty depressing, and it is. But it actually ends with a kind of an optimistic note that, you know, if we do things right, it actually, things might work out for us, even though there might not be as much work to go around as there used to be. The other one is written by the same guy who wrote Remains of the Day, excellent novel about an AI sentient robot.
Amazing. This truly is bringing us to the world, I think, of Star Wars, when you saw the robot fix Luke's hand. Last question, since you're an optimist. What's one thing that's surprising you that's actually moving faster in this realm than you're expecting? And then on the reverse, maybe things that aren't keeping pace with where you thought they would already be for where we are now.
Well, let me start with the second one. So I didn't have time to get into it, but real-time tracking of actual anatomy instead of fiducial kind of reflective markers is really kind of the next thing. And I think that there's a company here that's working on that and doing some interesting stuff. The way we track the bones right now is we drill these reflective arrays in the bone. So the camera is not actually tracking the bone. It's tracking these simple geometric reflective things. To track the actual bone, you need a huge amount of computing power because you're tracking millions of pixels all at once. So you need really fast cameras and you need a lot of computing power in the operating room to be able to do that. But if you can do that, you've eliminated 3/4 of the steps to do a robotic joint replacement. You can just flash an image. It registers the bone, knows where it is, knows what it is, knows where the cartilage is, and then can track it in real time. You could take the world's crappiest orthopedic surgeon and potentially have them do a knee replacement in 15 minutes. If you can implement that type of technology, the cameras and the computing power for the OR, I don't think are quite there yet, but they're getting there.
And this is an area where what's going on in other industries brings up that compute, brings up those cameras, other sensors, all these other things that hopefully come back to do what you're describing.
We need him.
Yeah. Well, we could spend hours here. Thank you all so much. This was absolutely amazing. And thank you, Stefano, for bringing us together.
That was an incredible lineup. If you enjoyed today's session, follow us here and on LinkedIn for more insights. Join us next week for DocSF Science, where I'll be joined by Dr. Fabrizio Billy of UCLA and Dr. Emel Demirchan to discuss the year's most significant AI papers and what they mean for the future of orthopedics.